everybody. Thanks so much for joining us. We are here to discuss EV and utilities, friend or foe. My name is Hannah Bascom. I will serve as the moderator for this session. My role is the Chief Market Innovation Officer at Uplight. Uplight is a climate technology company working with utilities and others in the energy ecosystem in order to deliver energy savings, virtual power plants, engage consumers to be part of the clean energy transition. Lon, you want to introduce yourself next?
I'm glad you're sitting between us because we don't know if we're friend or foe yet.
That's right. I got to keep you apart.
So Lon Huber, I'm Senior Vice President at Duke Energy, so I lead a pricing customer solution. So think of energy efficiency, rooftop solar, battery storage, community solar, things of that nature help solve our customer needs and help them meet their goals.
Asim?
Asim Kapoor, I run our products team within General Motors, specifically GM Energy, working on all our charging and energy management solutions for B2B and B2C segment.
All right. Perfect. So to start off and set the stage, let's do a little quiz. Do either of you know when the electric grid was created? When was it founded? The year that Edison started the thing?
I feel like I should know.
You should definitely.
Both of you.
No, but he
I worked in New York for two decades for Con Ed, the utility that started everything. I think it was like in the 1800s.
Yep, that's right. 1882. That's pretty good. All right, Thomas Edison unveiled the first power plant at Pearl Street Station in South Manhattan. Okay, next question. What year was the ICE vehicle invented? When was that patent filed?
I believe it was two decades after. I was 1885 or...
1886. Yes, that's right. A vehicle powered by that's right, by a gas engine. Okay, next question. What about the electric vehicle? When was that created?
Shouldn't you be asking them some of these things too?
That's true.
We did not know about these questions.
That's true. You would have studied up before. So, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
All right, so when was the electric car invented?
Yeah. About the same time. That's right. Yeah.
That's what I was going to say.
1888 was when the first EV patent was granted, and an EV appeared in an Iowa parade. Fun fact. So here we are, 140 years later, after both the grid and vehicles really got started. And we are at the very beginning of the next transformation of both of those industries, right? So both utilities and the electric grid, as well as vehicles. And I am always interested in the parallels as these things are both unfolding. So I actually, in my research for this panel, did a lot of reading up on GM. GM has been in the electric vehicles business basically this whole time.
Yes. I will not elaborate beyond that, because usually the next question is, well, what happened?
We're going to get there, don't worry. But, you know, as people rush to decarbonize, electric vehicles really are coming. So we will, in a second, talk about some of the doom and gloom headlines that we've seen recently about that. But I think, indisputably, this transition is happening. And on the utility side of things, for the first time in a couple of decades, load growth is real. It's happening. And I don't know if you agree with this, but the folks that I spend my time with are kind of freaked out about that. They're like, oh, we don't know. We have to retire all these fossil fuel assets. And there's new data centers that are being, you know, created because of AI, and they want to get hooked up in our territory. We don't know how we're going to power that. And now there's all of these also home electrification and vehicle projects that are coming as well. So all of this is a lot. And it means that we are going to fundamentally have to run the grid in a different way than we have been up until now. So we're on the precipice of a lot of change. Utilities and EV owners and EV manufacturers have to communicate with each other and really work together in a way that they haven't in the past. And this is bound to create some opportunities and also some tensions. So excited to dig in. Are we friend or are we foe? So. To really kick off the discussion, these doom and gloom headlines that I mentioned, we've seen maybe the trend around electric vehicles not coming as quickly as we thought, but we also know a million EVs sold last year, so starting to get there. So I guess GM, what's the GM perspective, Asim?
Yeah, I think you know there's a lot of articles in the news around how we're seeing tepid growth. The way we look at it is there's still a significant increase that is happening year over year in the growth rate. Yes, perhaps the projections or the forecasts that were done last year are coming down, but nonetheless, like we're committed to an EV-only future. We are still committed to having all our retail brands be electrified by 2035, and we're making the investments to launch cutting-edge EVs. In fact, this year we're going to have 8 new EVs coming out into the market. So we're actually pretty bullish, as it relates to our investment strategy and bringing our customers to drive EVs.
And just for all of our reference, talk about the size of these EVs relative to like an average house. How big are those batteries?
Yeah, that's a really good question. They're typically the first set of EVs that we launched with the Bolt, which is one of our most popular brands, was around 75 kilowatt hour. Some of the new EVs that are on the trucks that are coming out, like the Equinox, the Blazer, the Sierra, are going to be around 200 kilowatt hours, anywhere from 150 to 200 kilowatt hours. So just to put that in perspective, what that means is if you have an average storage device in your home, the EV would be almost 10 times the size of that storage that you can actually get in one vehicle than to deploy a small power wall in your home.
It's a lot of, you need a lot of electrons to power those things. So in your territories, and maybe for the audience, talk about where is Duke, just in case they all don't know.
Sure, so Duke, Indiana, Ohio, Kentucky, and then the Carolinas, and then Florida. So just a few little areas.
Yeah, so very diverse service territory. So what are you seeing on EV adoption across the board?
Yeah, so from end of 22 to end of 23, we saw a 50% increase. So we see the growth, and again, it might not be the 70% that a consultant predicted in 1 year, but if you look at where the projections were and maybe around like 21, it's right on target with those projections. And again, like we just have to be careful, like nothing actually happens as people model like a gradual ramp up or an even linear ramp up from forecasts. It's always gonna be like this as economic conditions happen, as new models become available, right? So, we plan for the long term, and we're not, changing things just on a, month to month, but we're definitely seeing the growth.
And how, I talked a little bit about just the increase in load growth overall. How are you thinking about that and planning for this further growth of EVs going forward?
Yeah, so there's a few ways to think of the infrastructure that supports the energy sector. You have the generation facilities, then you have the transmission, and then you have the local distribution. So those are sort of the three main components. In terms of generation, as I said before, we bake this into our long-term planning forecast. So we're ensuring that there's enough generation. And with EVs, with just some type of managed charging or off-peak charging, you solve for that generation issue. Where it gets a little bit more complicated is what we call hyperscale or hyperlocal issues. So that's deep in the distribution system, where you might have a concentration of, like, say, a fleet in one location that you need to build out, and that can take time. There's supply chain challenges right now in the industry, and so that is where a lot of our attention is. And the same managed charging solutions that solve the big generation, they can be adapted for these local scenarios and just a little, with just a little bit more complexity, a little bit more nuance than the bulk system, but they can do the same type of thing and help solve those challenges. So what we're doing is we're doing advanced modeling to identify these areas in the grid, and then we're asking regulators to help us be proactive and ready the grid in those locations. So a popular one is near airports, where you have a lot of different companies, whether it's rental car, or whether it's delivery companies. Those are no regrets areas to get ahead and invest, instead of doing piecemeal. Every time one customer electrifies, we upgrade the grid, and then we have to upgrade again to the next one. That's a lot more expensive in the long run for the entire system. So that's why we're being more proactive on the hyper-local scale.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So on the managed charging front, the research that we have done is that most normal consumers don't ever really think about how they're going to charge their vehicle until they get it home in the garage. And the notion even of managed charging, probably most people aren't familiar with this, right? So, and in case anyone in the audience is not familiar with this, managed charging is just the idea that you should shift your charging away from the times of the day where there are the most other demands on the grid and the least amount of renewables in particular that are available. So usually this is avoiding charging during the like 4 to 9 p.m. period. So we know that this is true. Are you seeing this, Asim, in the research that you all do with your consumers, and does it impact their purchase decisions?
So I think what we've seen our customers. So first of all, I think you know some of the facts around EV charging behavior is that 80% of the charging happens at home, right? And which is a very very significant shift from the way customers are accustomed to actually you know fueling their vehicle at the pump. So we definitely see the fact that you know the customer is charging at home. We also have a lot of intelligence on the vehicle, you know, through our OnStar platform to be able to understand like consumer behavior on when they're charging and what their preferred state of charge is. I believe your specific question regarding like do consumers are actually sensitive to the changes in price. I think it depends on where they live, right? In states like California, where you know there's a lot of advancement with time of use tariffs, there's generally a very heightened degree of awareness. Also, you know, if resilience comes into play as well, right? How the consumer actually thinks about EVs. However, there are parts of the country where you know the rates are not. You know, changing or not, they're not dynamic, and in those cases, you know, the consumers are not necessarily as price sensitive. But we do see an opportunity. You know, as we are actually releasing those capabilities, we're working with a host of utility companies across U.S. To deploy like what we call these proof of value pilots to be able to actually demonstrate to the utilities that our EVs can be responsibly managed. They can react to you know grid price signals. And in those scenarios, you know, we've seen that the customers are actually very engaged. You know, they actually want to see how, as long as their preferred state of charge is managed, and you know, and they input those preferences in the app, you know, they are more than happy to have the EVs react to the grid whenever it's needed, as long as you know they have the state of charge that can be balanced.
Yeah. So. As a kind of a comparable example, we at Uplight also run a bunch of smart thermostat load management programs, and we find that when customers are buying a smart thermostat, if they can get it enrolled in these energy management programs right at the beginning, so as soon as they put the thing on their wall, it's already signed up, they are, you know, 2 to 5 times more likely to actually sign up. So you can get like 80, 90% of customers at the time of purchase to say, sure, I will join that program, but if you have to then later on recruit them and get them to like you know, dig out their utility account information and, you know, proactively sign up, you get a much lower, like 20 to 30% enrollment rate. So I think it's really important to consider, especially since we're early in the adoption curve, how do we get more customers to, right from the beginning, sign up for these kinds of programs?
Well, I think that's key. And that's, you know, frankly, why we use Uplight too for our marketplace, because it, and you know, there's Black Friday sales. There's a bunch of different ways to get in front of the customer, and then to have a pre-enrollment in these types of programs, because that's the easiest thing. You don't want the customer to have to think about this, and just a simple opt-in to these programs, so that again, you're solving for that generation issue, and then eventually you can modify the program to solve for the local issues. But there's a lot of things that I worry about with load growth, and EVs, as long as there's a basic element of managed charge, is not one of them. I'm right, like a new data center that's 1 gigawatt and is on almost all the time is so significantly more than even a lot of EVs out there that's really what is keeping me up at night.
So you mentioned resiliency also in customer consideration. So I'm interpreting that as customers' ability to power their home off of the car.
That's right.
Okay. So talk also about how customers are thinking about that benefit, and then if utilities are also considering the vehicle-to-grid applications.
Yeah, so you know, we're actually pretty bullish on the opportunity to offer our customers the ability to be able to power their home with the vehicles. So come the middle of you know this year, we'll be launching our first vehicle-to-home product offering with the Silverado EV that will go on sale for our retail customers. And the technology essentially would allow for a customer to be able to power their home, you know, using the EV Silverado. It had, you know, the purchase of the vehicle will come with a bidirectional charger, and then the customer can invest in additional equipment, you know, that allows for them to power the home. What we do find is, you know, it's a new product category. We want to definitely introduce that. What we're trying to get the customer comfortable with is that, look, there's a lot of capacity in that battery, a lot more than you need. And we've been running tests with our employees, you know, as part of the program before rollout. And, you know, it's just the results have been really, really positive in the context of, you know, how the consumer behavior is evolving around where you can trust the vehicle to power your home for up to 3 days, 4 days. So there's definitely the opportunity we see that. I think the flip side of that is, it all comes down to is accessibility and the availability of the charging infrastructure, right? Because what the customer really cares about is that, do I have enough charge in my vehicle at the time that I need it? And I am open to sharing or using that resource, anything above that state of charge, if I have to power my home or eventually even to vehicle to grid technology, provided I have that certainty. And I think, so that's really what we're solving for now, making sure that when the consumer buys the vehicle, at home, where they're charging, they also have the optionality to then invest in vehicle-to-home capability, and then, you know, fast-following, partnering with, you know, companies like Duke Energy to be able to unlock vehicle-to-grid capability. You know, but we see this as a stepping stone in that journey in terms of, you know, getting customers comfortable with the first stage before we take them to the next stage and say, well, now you can power the grid.
And we're really excited about the vehicle-to-grid capabilities. It is one thing to be able to, you know, help with the home, and so that's great. We'll take it, but we want to go next level, which is actually taking that battery, exporting it out to help the grid during high stress situations and, you know, extreme weather events. But again, within the boundaries that the customer sets, right? So, you know, we were not going to be draining any batteries or anything like that. But given the size that you heard earlier from Asim, there's a lot of energy in those batteries to begin with. And so, it, you know, if you have a lot of EVs all with this capability, you actually don't need to you know, take a huge amount of that battery because you've got so many and you're, you know, targeting a limited number of hours. So we think there's a lot of promise there. We were one of the first utilities in the country to have a vehicle-to-grid tariff that was approved in North Carolina by our regulators. So we're hoping the technology progresses and quickly get to vehicle to grid and get customers enrolled in these programs.
And do you think that the challenge to getting these programs scaled is technology, or is it customer perceptions, or is it regulators, or what are the barriers?
I think there's a mix. I think one of the biggest ones will be the cost of the hardware to enable that type of transaction. And that can go for vehicle to home as well. It's early stages, and I know, you know, a lot of technology companies are working on bringing those costs of that hardware down. But, you know, when you think, well, if you're going to be moving, do you want to put a few thousand dollars into electrical work in your garage, right? Like, well, I'm not sure, right? What's the payoff? And so I think there's a reluctance there, and then it probably gets into the consumer perceptions. And I'm curious to see, you know, how you think the order is on the friction points. But I think that on the latter, we can do the education and the software experience, which I think is another area that needs a lot of work. The customer experience around that software can also help and to make sure the customer is comfortable. Like, hey, you know, you can override or just set where you want it, but also make it easy for them to see the value proposition of the program. And so when we filed our vehicle to grid, we wanted to make it very simple for the customer to understand exactly the amount of money they were saving each month. And then we'd have bonuses for them on top of that too, depending on how often their vehicle is plugged in during an event. So we want to make it just very upfront, easy for the customer. So that'll solve that one. And then we need the tech folks to handle the hardware side and software.
Yeah, I think I'll just build on that to say that affordability remains like the biggest barrier right now in terms of, you know, how you launch. And first generation of all new technologies are, you know, usually expensive. And so how do we actually drive down that cost curve in order to improve such that it can really, you know, drive adoption? I think underpinning that is also EV affordability, right? And the trend that has to also unlock over the next few years is that we have to have EVs that are in the 40 to 50 grand price range, which is where we see majority of the ICE vehicle sales happening. And the industry is trending towards that, right? Between us and our competitors, like, we're all moving, you know, really fast towards that. Installation costs, I think, also, you know, matter when you look at the total installed cost of the asset, right? And it depends on where you live and the amount of work that you have to do at your home in order to, you know, deploy that technology. And so as we look at what must be true and we're tracking these metrics in order to continue to invest and unlock this product category, we're also looking at, how does the consumer actually think about asset value, right? Because the EV purchase or your car purchase is the second largest purchase you make outside of your home. And so the residual value of the asset is also very, very important to the customer. It's important to the industry. And how we're going to manage that and track that is, you know, something that we think we can actually do really well for our consumer and build that confidence over time. And then market, you know, formation, right? So to the initiatives that Lon spoke about, like, you know, some of the cutting edge things that Duke Energy is doing, having these progressive tariffs that show the line of sight for a payback, right? Because ROI is going to come down to is there a value stream that you can create there as a payback over a certain set of, you know, period of years. And there needs to be certainty, right? So market signals have to be there. So we see those as the three major, things that must be true for this tech to scale. But we're very, very excited about the fact that as we look at some of the next generation technologies that are going to come out, you know, just in the very near future, in the next year or two, the price points are going to drop significantly. Like, we are seeing anywhere from like 40 to 60% improvement in the next 2 to 3 years. And 3+ years out, like 80% cost reduction, you know, which is huge. So we're pretty excited. We're pretty bullish. But at the same time, I think this year, the next year are going to be formative years around how consumers, start to get, you know, experience with this technology and build confidence.
So I'm hearing from both of you that this transition requires more engagement from the end consumers, the customers, right? So how are you thinking about building closer relationships with customers and making sure that they have the right information they need to better manage the costs associated with the vehicles, their charging experience, potentially participating in, you know, vehicle to grid in the future?
Yeah, I mean, for us, it's almost giving them an easy button and making a seamless journey for them from start to finish. And we call it our grid to the garage strategy. So, we make sure the premise is ready. We help them find a good electrician if they need it. We can get them a charger at no upfront cost. And then we have a variety of different ways that they can do managed charging and get some, you know, different pricing. And so already it's quite lucrative. It's probably in our North Carolina territory for where I live in Charlotte, it's about $1 a gallon equivalent, you know? And so that's pretty good, but it can be even better if you jump on a time of use rate or an off-peak charging rate, which we have. So, there's some savings with those options. So it's about making it just seamless for the customer and then thinking about, well, how do you get this in front of the customer? Like, how do they know about all these programs that exist? And, you know, typically, I think people just don't see the utility as, they have a suite of customer-centric programs. Like, it's typically not a thing. And it's like, and the utility industry has actually progressed a lot. It's not your parents' utilities anymore. The utility sector has decreased carbon emissions by over 40% since 2005. And that's handling all the economic growth that we've had since 2005. Duke has decarbonized by about 44%. Since 2005. So power generation used to be the number one source of carbon, and it's not anymore. Does anyone know what the number one source of carbon emissions is now?
Transportation,
yeah. Right? So that's now, like, that's what we're going to be tackling. And of course, like, we have to take care of the fleet, the generation fleet. There's still work to do. Do not get me wrong, especially now with new types of load growth. But it is about forming partnerships and understanding what the right channel and the right message is depending on the customer. And so it could be a dealership strategy. We go to auto shows. We even have data analytics that can tell us if a customer has an EV, so we can proactively say, hey, would you like to save a little bit more money if you jump on this type of rate? So It's those types of things that we're going to have to think. I don't have all the answers yet because it's new, but it's again sort of an all of the above strategy.
Yeah, I loved how he pointed out to the fact that transportation is the highest contributor to carbon.
Is he throwing you under the bus a little bit?
I think
literally.
So for us, I think where we feel that we can really play a role here and help unlock those opportunities for our joint customers is having a ubiquitous experience in the vehicle and any associated digital technologies that are with the vehicle. So increasingly, like the three major trends that are happening towards, you know, the vehicle industry is, you know, of course, the change in the powertrain to EVs. It's the software-defined vehicle architecture itself, right? So everything is going to be digitized, whether it's inside the vehicle and outside of the vehicle. And then, of course, autonomous vehicles. So as we're, you know, taking advantage of that second trend with software-defined architectures, we want to create that seamless experience such that the customer doesn't have to think about, like, you know, what's the right tariff I should be on, or when I'm on it, when I'm off it, right? So the vehicle should automatically take into account your preferences and respond to what your needs are. So that's the future that we're building towards. In order to get there, it's a partner strategy, right? So we need, you know, firms like Uplight. We need to partner with, you know, companies like Duke to make sure that every customer, because we sell vehicles in every state, right? So we need to have these relationships that allow our customers to be able to access those value streams. And then more importantly, do it in a way that is easy. And more importantly, you know, it's less complex, right? For those of us who are from the energy industry, like, we all geek out over over kilowatt hours and kilowatt hour rates. But, you know, majority of the customers actually we've seen is that, you know, they're indifferent to it, right? Yes, they care about fueling and they care about charging, but it's still a very small share of the wallet, you know, as it relates to the toll payment. And what we are looking to do is, like, we just want to make that a seamless transaction. If there are programs a launch team is offering in North Carolina, we want to make sure GM customers are positioned to take advantage of those programs at the point of sale with the dealer. So when they're, you know, driving away the vehicle from the lot, it should already be fully equipped with all those capabilities that, you know, that allow them to save the most money.
I actually wanted to ask a follow-on question about the dealers, because it seems like that's such a crucial moment of customer education. So how are you thinking about engaging with the dealers across the country? And then is Duke doing anything with the dealers in your territory?
Yeah, so let me start there. I think so what we are doing, you know, three tenets of our strategy within GM Energy is education first, right? So how do we actually empower our consumers and all our stakeholders? And we believe the dealers are actually a pretty big asset. You know, as 90% of, you know, U.S. population lives within a mile of, you know, a GM dealership. We have 4,000 dealers across our, you know, across
that
our...
That's a banana statistic. That's crazy.
And so in that respect, we feel like, you know, the dealers are actually a very, very important stakeholder. And in fact, one of our first vehicle-to-home product that we're going to actually launch is via the dealers. You know, we're actually enrolling dealers in our go-to-market strategy to be able to offer the products to our consumers. So we believe that education is the underpinning, you know, strategy that allows us to educate consumers around not only the use of the product, but also, you know, how to actually charge it, you know, cost effectively. And dealers are going to be a very, very important enrollment point, you know, where we make sure that our customers are educated. The other thing we're actually doing is also for dealers is creating the right incentive structures, right? So what's the right incentive that encourages them to learn about, you know, the programs that are being offered in their respective service territories? And so that's like an important part of our strategy as well. And then I think the third piece is like around charging. Today, the dealers historically, you know, have not had to worry about how do I get a charger at a customer's home, how do I refer them to the electrician, and what we are working on is building this white glove partnership. You know, in fact, QMerit, which is one of the Schneider-owned companies, is one of our partners where we are, you know, delivering this white glove service from the time that, you know, before your vehicle is going to get to your garage and you're going to take the delivery, you'll have the charger installed at your home. And as part of that, you know, our vision is that you would also have the vehicle enrolled into these programs, such that you know, the grid operators don't have to worry about, you know, how they're going to actually manage the assets.
Do you know what percent of customers in your territory would require electrical upgrades to get a level 2 charger?
Yeah, for our territories, we're actually in pretty good shape compared to other utilities, yeah. Just because we have a high rate of electrification with heating already. And
yeah.
So it is You know, I would say somewhere in the, around the 10% range, mm-hmm. most likely.
That's not bad. Yeah, because I think I live in San Francisco, and there's quite a lot of homes that have a 100 amp service, and so those homes would need an electrical panel upgrade and sometimes a utility service upgrade if they wanted to get a level 2 charger. And so never before has a customer bought a new car that was super expensive, got home only to discover, right, they have to literally like upgrade their house and then dump a bunch, you know, many thousands more dollars into that purchase. So I think that the engaging with dealers and utilities in advance is really important to make sure that, you know, the overall experience is good on an ongoing basis. I realized I'm supposed to be the timekeeper, but I don't have a phone or a watch. So how are we doing? 3:02. Okay, we got so much time. Okay, great. So, you know, what are the things that keep you both up at night as you're thinking about the opportunities and, you know, the potential challenges of this transition to decarbonization and an electrified future?
So for us, I think we see a lot of opportunity. We are very, very excited about the fact that as General Motors rolls out more EVs, we have an opportunity to help our consumers manage the energy of those assets, you know, in a way that creates value, right? And for us, it's all about making it an unparalleled or differentiated mm-hmm. customer experience and how we actually want to deliver those capabilities. So we see the fact that, you know, we're going to have cutting edge affordable EVs with the state-of-the-art software. How do we actually, you know, get the customer comfortable with charging and discharging their vehicle and then creating more value, right? So we see EVs kind of at the tip of the iceberg right now as we think about, you know, that shared asset, you know, economy, you know, that'll be unlocked with the batteries on wheels, right? So to the vision that, you know, Lon laid out at the beginning. So I think that's something that we're super excited about. But I think to get there, it's all about how do we make sure the charging infrastructure is available, how it's mm-hmm. it gets deployed, and that's where we see all our efforts are going, you know, mm-hmm. towards today, right? We're making sure, and we've done a bunch of things. Just recently, we've announced, you know, a partnership with the Tesla Supercharging Network to ensure, you know, make sure our vehicles are, you know, can access the 15,000 fast chargers on the Tesla network. We've also partnered with, you know, 6 other OEMs to launch, you know, a new entity called Iona that's going to deploy 30,000, you know, DC fast chargers in the next 2 years. So we're leaning in pretty heavily to, you know, to solve for the charging infrastructure challenge, because we see that as an important unlock. And then I think lastly, from a brand perspective, you know, we're looking at introducing all new powertrains, right, whether it's electric vehicles, whether it's hybrids, and driving down that cost curve, right? Because we want to improve EV affordability. And we're, you know, as we look at our product roadmap, including like the products that are coming out in the market, you know, we have by far some of the best products that General Motors has ever had in the market. And so we're very excited about that, including, you know, the price point at which we're going to start releasing them for mass market adoption.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for me, it's getting to the energy transition in general, and making sure we have cleaner and cleaner energy. And the simple reality is it's very hard to get things built today. And the utility sector is going through a big build cycle that really hasn't happened for decades. And it's tough. I mean, just to get something sited, the permitting, and then not even going into labor force, not even going to supply chain, transformers, trying to get, you know, transformers, some aren't even made in the U.S. at all. Some take 2 to 3 years to get delivered. So that is definitely keeps me up at night, because we want to continue that momentum. And then with electric vehicles, I think there's an optics problem to possibly solve. We don't want to get this cult, you know, caught in the culture wars, because it shouldn't. This is about performance. This is about functionality, practicality, and so we have to make sure that the EV owners don't increase costs to the grid in the long run, right? This is a network system. Everybody's connected. What your neighbor does actually does impact you in these in a utility type of system. And so I think the key thing is to show, like, hey, first, do no harm. Like, these EVs are not, you know, putting undue stress. They're helping actually in the long run reduce costs, because they're using more energy, which increases the utilization of the system, those are some good stories. So we have to first just, you know, we have to make sure do no harm and that we don't have to, that there's not a high cost to avoid that harm. So it can't be like, well, you know, I could really hurt your grid, but you could, if you could just pay me, then I won't, right? That won't fly optically. At the same time, we need to show how much value there is to the grid, all the grid benefits from like the vehicle-to-home, vehicle-to-grid type of transactions that we're talking about, because that can be really powerful, again, as you start to get mass adoption and you have that control as we increasingly have more variable energy on the system from different clean energy sources. So those I think, are sort of two key things on top of the mind right now.
Yeah, that all makes a ton of sense. So real talk here. There's a reason you're on this stage, because you are doing some really exciting and progressive stuff. But I've also heard a lot of naysayers talk about the fact that, you know, vehicle-to-grid or virtual power plants, where you are aggregating a bunch of batteries and a bunch of smart thermostats and other kinds of assets together, and you use those instead of having to go and buy or build power from a gas peaker, for example. So I've heard a lot of, oh, these things aren't reliable. Like, what do you think that we collectively need to do to build confidence that these resources can be a core part of the clean energy future?
Well, one, it's set the right expectations, use the right language, right? Like, I would never use virtual power plants in front of, like, you know, normal, like, politicians or anything like that, right? It's distributed, we call it distributed power plants. We've been doing different variations for a while. It's getting much more sophisticated in two-way, which is why, you know, we partnered, you know, with companies such as Uplight to help orchestrate these things and help with those hyper-local locations. But I think we have to, you know, the all those resources, they're not going to solve all of our problems, right? Like I said before, it could take you a decade to get the level of distributed technologies that just one data center would take up in a year, right? Yeah. So and again, this is all new stuff, like, you know, so we have to understand the dynamics of the situation and then properly set expectations. And what Duke Energy said, hey, we need all the above. We've got to do as much energy efficiency, as much demand response, as much as all the new cool, you know, connected devices as possible. But still, we're going to need to build central generation. Still, we're going to have to build transmission. There's just no way of getting around it. And so each set of technology has its role to play, and we should not be neglecting any of those categories for, you know, reasons that aren't really founded. And so I think the more we get experience with the new technologies, the more we can prove it out. But in most of my states, the policymakers, the regulators all see that these distributed resources do add value. And we've had a great track record with them, especially in energy efficiency and some forms of like HVAC demand response, that they're willing to continue on this and making sure that those types of resources are a core pillar of the transition.
Yep. So how are you working with both Duke and other utilities around the country? And I want, you don't have to name names. What are some real high points and what are some low points that you're seeing?
Who's the best to work with?
So that is obviously Duke Energy.
Thank you.
Goes without saying. So we were doing a host of, you know, what I said earlier is our proof of value pilots. You know, we've got about five of the large, you know, 10 largest investor-owned utilities partnering with General Motors in order to deploy smart charging capability, fleet energy management capability, and then also fast following our vehicle-to-home and vehicle-to-grid technologies. I think the high point is, and this probably, you know, feeds into the prior question as well, is how the unlock would happen is, companies like GM and Duke coming together in order to have interoperable assets, right? So how do you actually build a car that can, you know, easily interface with the grid, and you lower the technology barrier in terms of the transaction costs? So how can you actually lean in and create a standard, whether it's for bidirectional charging, that all OEMs, you know, follow? And NACS is a good example, right, around why all the OEMs are coming together is to drive you know, the adoption of one charging standard that would then allow to us to have benefit from the economies of scale. So I think that's like one of the high points that we're seeing, is because these pilots allow you to pick up, you know, those opportunities and how you can actually standardize that. So our vehicle product portfolio benefits from ensuring that all our vehicles going forward are smart charging enabled, right? So that's like, I would probably say is the, you know, is the biggest win or the high. We also see opportunities in terms of, like, you know, consumer adoption. We see that there are areas where firms like, you know, Uplight have done a lot of good work in terms of lowering the barrier for entry, and without having to rework or consumer's journey, not have to reintroduce the same concept again. You know, how can you actually benefit from existing practices and technologies that are already there, mm-hmm. such that the customer doesn't have to relearn? Yeah. And how can you take and scale that? So I think that's another opportunity. And historically, you know, a car company has never had to work with an energy aggregator or even a utility company, right? And so it's forcing a lot of innovation, and you know, the amount of collaboration that I'm seeing in the industry is very, very exciting. And it's you know, leading to us to come together, solve the problem for the benefit of the customer. So that's, I think, is probably the big, you know, big wins that I'm pretty excited about. And the fact that, you know, I worked for over two decades in an energy company and never dreamt of working for a car company and the reason why that came about was we, you know, can come in and solve for these energy solutions, you know, together as a firm, and that's what I'm really, really excited about.
Awesome.
Really support that standardization one. That is going to be key.
It's a, kind of a mess. All right. Well, in a sec, we'll take audience questions. So audience, think of questions. But do either of you have questions for each other?
Oh, wow.
I keep you on your toes.
Curveballs.
I don't know.
I was going to ask, what's the second highest contributor of carbon, Lon? After the transportation sector.
Still us, but
yes.
But again.
Just in case it wasn't lost on the audience.
But we're making a lot of progress.
And I mean, I actually think it's good that the two are converging, because it's easier to solve two problems once.
Yes. And the highest emitters can come together to actually solve the solution. And
it's
incredibly
that's
powerful.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
All right, we have a question. Up at the mic, thank you.
Strategist, and I have allergies. I think Austin Energy is a friend to EVs. They have their website and they advertise how many EVs are available for sale, and they provide the discounts, and they have a little dyno that they promote around to educate people on EVs. But they have some issues, obviously, with the handoff between the purchase and the permitting to actually install the EV charger at home. So it's like a bad customer experience, in my opinion. They want, almost immediately, they want the charger to, I guess, suppress their behavior, because they want the EV owners to actually charge off peak, which is a behavior change when you're trying to adjust to your new lifestyle with an EV car. So that's an issue, right? But in Austin, we have a lot of sun, so we have a lot of renewable energies, and so the electric bill that arrives to the EV users come with wind and solar and, you know, all of these different things. And at the end of the day, the consumer just cannot understand what the electric bill, you know, it looks like. And it's basically dependent on when, which source was purchased, at what time, and when the energy was generated. So I'm kind of wondering, to Duke, is that something that you're seeing? And for GM, how sophisticated is your EV charging infrastructure, and do you have your own repair people for the EV chargers?
Yeah, well, so a few things. One, it is said that the most complex machine in the world is the electric grid, and it's true. It is the most complex, and it's only getting more complex because of all the different generation sources, and then external factors. There's security concerns, there's climate risk and so forth. So how do you take a super complex system and then make it really easy on a bill that's mostly regulated by governmental entities, and they dictate to some extent like what's listed on the bill. So it's sort of hard. I think what we've tried to do is provide tools like in the app and online to try to simplify things, and give an estimate of, hey, what this will cost. So one of the pilots that we have with GM right now is actually a subscription energy pilot. So it says you can pretty much charge all that you want for $24.99 a month. That's what you're going to pay. It's all you're going to pay. And just to simplify that transaction for the customer. Of course, there's managed charging in that. And to your point, this might take a little bit of different customer behavior. But again, if I told you, hey, you're going to have to take your car to like this place, and then they're going to undo this bolt, and then this liquid's going to fall out, and you have to do this like every 6 months, and it's going to take you an hour every 6 months, like you'd probably be like, wow, that's going to be a pain. But now it's like, well, everyone does it, so it's okay. But so there's going to be some shifts. The key for all of us to solve is make these as simple and convenient as possible, but there will be some type of behavior change needed.
And the other thing that I'll add, so prior to joining Uplight, I was at Nest and Google for almost 9 years. And so one of the key learnings that we had is you can never lock customers out of taking control of their experience in their home. And we all know that, like, every now and again, you're going to have a party, or your mother-in-law is visiting, or you have to take your kid to a doctor's appointment, right? And your schedule is thrown off. And so the most important thing is that you have the ability to drive the car where you need to drive, when you need to drive it. And so I think, you know, so long as we are making sure that we are always delivering the customer expectation, then most, 99% of the time, does it matter if your car isn't charging at peak? No, probably not, because it doesn't inconvenience you, and it saves you a bunch of money.
Yeah, I'll just maybe answer briefly. It was a really good question regarding, how General Motors can help solve for that pain point with charger installation. And we're doing like two straightforward things there. One, we're partnering with the right installers to make sure that we're transparent with the customer, help them understand the complexity, but then also provide that white glove service, right? So as I said earlier, for every Bolt customer, right, before the Bolt is delivered at home, we actually, have the charger installed. I think the second thing is also, as we're now testing and scaling, like partnering with utilities to understand like where are some of the challenges, whether it's permitting or in the future with interconnection as things evolve. So, but we're actively working through that, including having a service network that supports the chargers.
All right, great. Next question.
Good afternoon. Thank you for speaking with us today. My name is Colby, and as I was listening to your panel, I think that the ideas behind this are fantastic, and I'm just trying to imagine ways, and pardon me if this gets a little bit holistic in terms of I've been listening to a lot of South by panels throughout the week, and I'm pulling from different things. But I was thinking about both electricity bills and dealership experiences, and how both are frankly terrible. And, not in regards to your respective companies, but the general perception of such, it tends to be fairly common. And has there been any discussion about how to unite these things, and perhaps extend the dealership experience long after the actual point of sale? Because I think about how you spend, however many hours test driving and like sitting and talking with your salesperson, the manager, the F&I guy, and going through miles worth of paperwork, et cetera, and all you want to do is get out of there. You often don't even want to deal with the delivery experience. But to harness how AI is able to do data analysis and help figure out over the course of the first month or two of ownership, oh, this is how a consumer is utilizing their vehicle, their features, and also the charging, and then also be able to look at where they can optimize different power incentives.
Yeah, it's Toby, right?
Colby.
Colby. So I think, first of all, I think you should join our product team.
We're going to hire this guy.
Look, I think a really, really good question in terms of, in order to drive adoption with these technologies, you have to really impact the customer journey. And one of the things that we are doing with our launch of the new vehicle-to-home portfolio is we're standing up an e-commerce website that allows the dealer to refer the customer to us. So the way it's going to work is, in the future, the way we reimagine that journey is, like you're overwhelmed with, you know, signing 100, you know, forms when you're buying the EV. At that point in time, if there's interest, you transition that customer over to us. We have an EV energy concierge, you know, that would actually virtually, you know, interact with you, and also essentially can, you know, through a 3D showroom can actually walk you through all the products, can help you understand, you know, how to get the charger installed and what would that experience look like. So we're actively rethinking, you know, what that experience, you know, should look like for the customer. What we do see opportunities is, you know, like you just said, AI-enabled agents, right, that can actually, you know, answer the questions. And we're introducing this concept called Energy Genie that can, you know, very quickly help, you know, customers just understand the basics, right? Like, what does the size of the battery mean? What does the charging rate mean? How many hours would it take for you to charge your vehicle if you buy, you know, a Silverado versus a Bolt? What type of insulation you need at home, whether it needs a panel upgrade or not? So trying to get ahead of all of those things that the customer will face the moment they leave the dealership, we're trying to, like, get ahead of that upfront and introduce that new sales. So, like, we're excited about it. At the same time, we see that, you know, we have to educate the dealers as well, and we're investing a lot of resources in educating the dealers because they are our ambassadors, right? They're the ambassadors of our brand. But at the same time, you know, they have to believe, you know, in the technology and the opportunity. So we're working on both fronts.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
My name is Talis. Asim, I have two questions for you. So the first is, where I live in the Bay Area, an old house, no air conditioning, you know, historically, et cetera. I have a 100 amp panel. If I want white glove service from you, how do you deal with the time delays in terms of getting PG&E and everything else set up to actually change that panel, which I assume Duke's service time is much better than PG&E's in the Bay Area right now. So how do you handle something like that from a white glove service point of view? Because, you know, if you have to wait 6 to 12 months to sell me a vehicle, that doesn't work very well.
Yeah, is that the first question? Or
that's
are those two questions?
That's the first question. Yeah. The second question is, what's GM's position looking forward with respect to wireless charging? Because as you're looking for bi-directional availability to help with vehicle to grid, then you're not as worried about everybody plugging in every time they come into a space.
Yeah. So on the first question, you know, when we sell the charger today, it can be throttled. I think there was one of the audiences earlier mentioned a question around, hey, you know, Austin Energy, you know, when you deploy the charger. So the charger does have the capability where, you know, it's rated at 19.5 kW, but you can use it at 7.5. Like, it's a simple setting, right? It's a toggle switch that you can do. So when we deploy the charger at the onset, we want to make sure it's compatible with your, you know, existing electrical infrastructure. We have close to about 50,000 installations under our belt, right? Experience that we've done. We've also had a lot of experience partnering with utilities, including a large network of electricians that we've built through our partner QMerit, in order to understand the pain points. So we can very reliably tell where you live with your zip code and the type of home you have, what's the likelihood that you would need a panel upgrade, and how long would it take? And until then, how do we actually get the vehicle to you at home and make sure that the charger you buy has the right setting, you know, such that you can start charging right away, and then over time we transition you into, you know, the right setting after the panel upgrade. And look, we can't control for everything that, you know, that is outside our control, like, you know, for instance, the amount of service upgrades that it takes. But also the next quick thing I want to mention is where the technology is headed, right, with smart panels. You know, there are so many entities that are actively looking at introducing products. And what we are seeing now with our vehicle-to-home product launch is that very quickly the industry is going to move towards standardizing the charger and the panel into one asset that can, you know, be smartly controlled, such that you can mitigate the need for, you know, for grid upgrades.
If you are a normal person that doesn't know how many amps on your panel, QMerit actually has a tool where you can take a picture of it, and it will use AI and tell you what your capacity is, which is super cool.
Yeah. So I just want to answer, you know, that part in terms of how we're addressing the challenge, right? Because we recognize that that white glove service, you know, has elements that we can't control, you know, we can't control directly. And the second part, I apologize,
The wireless.
Okay, wireless. So I can't, without going into a lot of details on our product roadmap, I will share that we are looking at the technology. We are trying to understand it does address one, you know, pain point is that you don't have to have the vehicle plugged in, right? Because if it's wirelessly there, it's going to come down to is the economies of scale and the price point, right? Today, because it relies on, you know, induction-based charging, you have to have a lot of equipment added to the vehicle itself in order to enable that. And as we talked about, you know, EVs are not, you know, we're trying to like drive the cost curve down. So we are tracking the technology very closely, but for vehicle to grid and vehicle to home type, we see those are advanced use cases. You know, over time, that technology can unlock. But beyond that, I can't share much around, you know, where we are with that.
All right, rapid fire, last few questions.
Hi, I'm going to move quick. I'm Ben. This represents a new multilateral partnership between private homeowners, utilities, and the producers of essentially the utility equipment. First of all, how do you see that partnership shaping up? Secondly, how can it be used to improve equity?
Well, to our panel, friends, you know, or foes, and I think it's with all those parties, it's friends with grid benefits. And that's what we've got to unlock. And so that is
how long have you been thinking about that?
I actually, when he was giving his last answer, I was looking at that up there and it popped into my mind. Not to say that you gave a super long-winded answer, but but yeah, I mean, it has to be we all have to be connected because we want to make sure there's the do no harm and maximum value to the grid. And then we have to make sure that we have the right program structures in place so that it can be widespread. So for instance, when you know we're just talking about getting the premise ready, in North Carolina, we offer up to $1,100 to help with those service panel upgrades or anything that you need. That helps with equity if you don't have that capital. In addition, we have different financing offers so that a customer can, they'll start saving day one from the EV, use some of that savings to then slowly pay that off. So I think those are a few ways to do it.
Yeah, I would just add, I think one other key element is going to be the used EV market. Yeah. You know, we see a really, really, you know, a strong opportunity there in terms of getting EVs, just improving equity, right, and accessibility to, and so we are actively partnering with utilities, you know, specifically like PG&E in California, in order to see how we can launch used EV programs with them that drives both adoption and at the same time, you know, makes, you know, significantly increases the value because that's the most price sensitive consumer that can benefit from having, you know, the smart charging dollars because they can save the money, right? So we're pretty excited about that because we do see that that's going to be an important unlock for those communities.
And then the charging infrastructure helps the grid in those areas. Makes a lot of sense. Second question.
Second.
How about the actual public charging issue? How are you partnering on that large gap? Thank you.
Yeah, public charging
quickly. 1 minute.
Okay, great. I'll try and be very quick. I think this is going to require a significant collaboration across OEMs, and I'm we're very bullish with our IONNA partnership because it's like for the first time ever, seven of the largest OEMs in the world are coming together in order to build public charging infrastructure, and use that collective supplying power, bargaining power to make sure that that infrastructure gets built. So I think that's a very, very positive sign in terms of how competitors can come together to unlock, an opportunity for the better of the customer.
My question sort of plays on that last one about public charging. I'm assuming that the vast number of the EV consumers right now are homeowners. So in a city like Austin, where over 50% of the population are 50% of the over 50% of the households are actually renters, I think that speaks to what y'all were saying about future technology enabling other types of consumers who are renters. And in a city that such as Austin that has terrible public transit, like we're just a car-centric place and we're going to be for a very long time.
Yeah.
So.
There's a lot of multifamily strategies, but I'm in your camp. When I lived about 7 years, there's no way I could get charging to the car. And so like, these are, what we're experimenting with is attaching a charger to a light pole so that, you know, to the extent the community has light poles, boom, you've got something there. So there's this is something that a lot of people are trying to solve for.
I mean, it's not just for renters. It can be for also people who just don't have garages and live in urban areas like me. Yeah.
Just very quickly, are you seeing EV culture wars emerge within public utility commissions across the country?
This one's for you.
I have heard about this, so yes. Mm. there are definitely, and you know, my states are all perfect. But there are some other states I've heard on where there, you know, you do start to see this pop up. And that's why it's so important to show, again, member of the grid benefits, the value that this provides in the long run to everybody. And in the beginning, you know, people that were installing AC units, that was an issue back then, right? And we all solved that together and it scaled up and now most people have it. And it was, there's a few bumps along the way, but there's a lot of similarities between how that technology got adopted in EVs in terms of grid impacts. And so yeah, it's on all of us to try to make sure that we avoid this. And as a car guy myself, it's like, to me, it's just all about performance. The performance is there, I'll buy it. And if not, I won't. And that's a consumer choice.
All right, so I think that is all the time we have. Thank you all for your very good questions. Thank you, Lon and Haseem.
Yeah, thank you.